Well, hey, welcome everybody. This is Dave. I hope you're doing great. I want to spend time at the beginning, at least a few minutes, with any questions or follow-up or observations that you have, anything you'd like to talk about to address what we addressed the initial seminar or things that have emerged in what you're looking at in terms of the outline or the work. Let me ask if you would manage the background noise and be on mute if you're not speaking, because especially if you're on a cell phone or a computer phone, they're static and you probably don't hear. So I want to keep the purity of the focus on what we're talking about. But I'm interested in thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful for us to talk about. Anyone? You cannot have listened to me for an hour and be clear about everything I said. That I don't even do that. So I'm, and I even agree with most of what I say. So I'm interested in thoughts or questions or input. What was your takeaway from that first seminar? Just in a succinct sentence, did you reflect on that to have a takeaway, or as you do now, what was your takeaway from that?
Hey, Dave, this is Joe.
Hey, welcome. Hey.
Good. Yes.
Man, how are you?
Yes, I'm back. I'm back. I'm glad to be back
okay.
Home. I'm doing good. Thank you. Yes. The biggest thing, I listened to that recording probably 5 or 6 times while I was gone, and the biggest thing that kept sticking out is the part where you said, not my story, when a physician prescribes medication or tells you what to do and the person does not do it because it's not their story. And so that stuck with me about my own wellness story and speaking with others. So that's my big takeaway.
Well, thank you. I think that's important, whether you're a parent or anyone else trying to have somebody think about the way you think about things and know that it really doesn't work that way. So that's just a practical application. That's one of the most common misconceptions is that once we explain something to somebody and how we see it, we assume they're going to see how we see it and think that that's right. But that is not the way our minds and brains work. In fact, so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way the mind and brain work. So we're going to be talking in this seminar about approaches to changing behavior that work because the ones that work consider what it does to someone's personal story. And when you give instructions, orders, it doesn't take into account what it does to someone's personal story. In other words, their identity. Because that's the final step that makes change permanent is when someone transforms the operating model of who and what they are, their identity, to incorporate that change, that transformation, because we always return to our identity. Whatever we do that's different, we'll always return to our identity. When that identity transforms according to the changes and the evolution of a process that is engaged by the mentor coach client or anyone else, then it becomes permanent when it becomes a part of one's identity. So, yeah, so thanks, Joe. That's great. And it's a good review of what we talked about, in essence.
I got one more question, if you don't mind.
Please.
This is an open-ended one. Do you have a best practice of how to take notes when we're in seminar with you or going back and listening? Because I've tried all the different ways of doing it for the last 5 years. I have my own. I just want to know if you had one that could work for us.
That's the ideal answer you've already provided, that it is the individual's process and what works for you. Now, what I've done is provide a fairly annotated outline so that you don't have to take a lot of notes, but it's the same question about what do you do with taking notes with a client. It's whatever works for you. You know, if whatever doesn't interfere with your listening, your full immersion and engagement, if you can jot notes while that's happening, ideally that... My hope is the outline is annotated enough that you can really listen and see if it makes sense what I'm saying, and you don't have to take a lot of notes. But that will vary with individual style. As you know, some people, you know, have different work and performance styles. But the important thing, I think, that is the bottom line for whatever style you have is that you put it in an output channel. There's been some really important research fairly recently that whatever we put in an output channel, it completes a circuit in the brain. Now, that output channel may be visual, it may be auditory, it may be kinesthetic, like writing, but, you know, when a group, a very simple example, this is out of England, a group read a story themselves, and a control group read the story out loud. Same story, matched controls. The group who read it out loud had a 40% better retention, understanding and retention on follow-up testing. So whatever you do, don't be a passive learner because you have to put it in an output channel. Now, for professionals and athletes, performing professionals and practicing professionals, that may need to be in different ways than just learning that we're talking about. It may be in performance. So whatever constitutes an optimum kind of deliberate practice, but that practice needs to include doing it. So that's a lengthy answer to a really good and simple question. Does that make sense, Joe?
Oh, yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thoughts and questions? Who else? How many of you know how to program a computer? Algorithms, pattern sequences? Anyone, actually? I mean, that question comes from somebody who consistently learned to turn his computer on the year before last. But what my point here is I'm going to teach you how to reprogram a brain. We don't know the algorithm formula, but we see the clues. And much of the response is automatic. The 90 to 95% of unconscious responses are based on the algorithms that we have inside for attachment patterns, behavior patterns, emotional engagements. So the process, here's the key, the process of the unconscious operating system comes alive in mentor coaching. Now, we focus often on the content because that's conscious and logical and intellectual, and that's what we're trained to do, to look at, you know, SMART goals and all the content. But the way you're going to really earn your money, the difference you're going to make that will make a difference for someone for the rest of their lives, is when you focus on the process of what comes alive that they're not able quite to say or do or grasp. It's from that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's unconscious that comes to be a focus then. So what we're going to do in this is the roadmap system that we're going to look at today. It's a deconstruction of someone's story in a systematic way of constructing a new one. It's 7 steps to understand and deconstruct. In this case, it's applied to a wellness story, but it can apply to any story. Life, money, relationship, career. To systematically construct and implement a new successful story. So that's what we're going to focus on today, and I'd suggest having your outline handy so you don't have to take a bunch of notes. Other thoughts or questions before we launch into the seminar itself?
Dave, this is Brenda Ferry speaking.
Welcome. Hey.
Go ahead. Hi. Yes. So I missed the first session, and I did just listen to it. I haven't had the time yet to catch up on all of these notes, but I'm finding everything that you're saying right now very helpful and very enriching for me. So I want to thank you for that. And I just wanted to introduce myself to the class right now because I haven't. This is my first attendance.
Well, great. Thanks for the check-in. I know I see from the dashboard there are a number of you, and welcome. I welcome your input, and if we don't get to something that you have as a question, don't hesitate to email me, and I'll incorporate that at the beginning of the next seminar, for example. So anything else? Thank you. Green, anything else?
Hi, Dave. This is Rob.
Okay. Hey, welcome.
Just so I know, just to make sure that I am following along where I need to, in the outline, will you be starting at page 1.3?
I am starting at Seminar 2, which is the beginning of the roadmap. We're going to talk about the 7 steps of the roadmap, and you'll see in the syllabus that corresponds with that module that has the roadmap. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, absolutely. Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode. I'll preserve some time at the end for us to have a discussion. So hang on, and if there's anything that you want to discuss or just clarify, jot it down, and we'll talk about it at the end. Okay, we've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now we're going to look specifically and closely at how to do that, the principles and practice of change. We're going to examine the 7 steps, the acronym, the roadmap process to create a new wellness story. It's a proven and scientific system integrating the mind and brain sciences, and we'll talk more about how that happens. To deconstruct and understand a current story, it's simply a way for you as a mentor coach to listen to someone telling their story and then to know how and where to engage to revise that story or to create a new one. It's a stepwise process to integrate psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching. So our focus is going to be on a wellness story. So the steps of the roadmap, the acronym, recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author new experiences, and program new wellness experiences with identity. Now, the most important thing if you want to change someone's habit, and we all have habits. They're the accumulation of our default modes of responding in particular ways. The best way to change a habit is not just to set a goal, but it's to focus on the system of how you get it. A goal is important, but it's not enough. And focus on the system I think, is really important. That's what the roadmap does. So each step is not necessarily easy, but the actual implementation of the ideas requires to change the way we think about our lives, breaking bad or outdated habits, developing new ones, and remaining disciplined over the long haul. So this seminar is going to cover the first four steps. We're going to look at the last three steps next seminar, because it's that important to look at this in detail, in my view. The first three steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself. So step one is to recognize authorship of your wellness story. Remember the premise. Each moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a new page. Insights, understanding, even coming to the end of the past, to end an old story, are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. And often, the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. This means that you have to take 100% responsibility for your life. So, how can we tell our life and wellness stories to ourselves in order to know which aspects work and which need to change? So there are four principles, in my view, in recognizing authorship in this first step. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Our beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Let me give you an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg, stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to move on or break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant then stays in the area determined by the length of the rope. Now, fast forward, this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size. It could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier, as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by its assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that then determines the same behavior in the adult, same belief system. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Second principle, we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. We construct our storylines from these premises. We have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work currently, or if they were tailor-made for an earlier time and had become outdated. We don't get what we want, we get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. Remember the two anthropologists. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This then actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Third principle, a new story can only occur in the present moment. Social scientists have discovered that when you measure someone's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates 35% over the next 3 months. Other behaviors with increased frequency, and think about what we're talking about from the perspective of a mentor coach with your client, asking if people intend to diet, to exercise, to plan, to structure, to eat certain foods. So state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. Have an accountability partner. Put it, in other words, in an output channel. The stated intention is most powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. Fourth principle, our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. In other words, our brains seek closure, whether or not it's accurate. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons they do what they do, but when asked for a reason, they'll readily give one, and they believe it because it consciously and logically makes sense. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure, perhaps without ownership or growth, like a finish without an ending. So, review the exercise in step one specifically. Recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.5 in the workbook. And notice the plot, meaning the core themes and storylines that inform what you look for and how you attribute meaning to what you find. And the storylines become your self-statement. Your wellness story is your self-statement. It's your construction. It doesn't exist until you write it. And I'd suggest you complete each exercise in step one before moving to step two, and the same with subsequent steps. I think this will give you the best idea of the impact of doing it, as well as how you want to apply this if you decide to for your clients. Step two, own your story. Review especially, beginning page 1.7, assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like adding a new dieter, adding a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. In other words, whenever you want to change a pattern, you first have to disrupt the current automatic pattern and then begin the new or different pattern and repeat it. So, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation I think will be useful. This is also in your outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. And I gave some examples in the workbook of empowering beliefs. I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. I can make the money I need. Limiting beliefs also influence both reality and behavior and have an effect emotionally and physically. For example, I can't find a time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. So that's what this step, in a sense, is about. You have to recognize that what you do is a choice rather than just the way things are. So here's a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that by talking about a couple of things. Point of reference, inactive versus passive. The point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. They may transfer responsibility, at least in some aspect, and this is what you're listening for as a coach, to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here are some examples of those with an external point of reference. Another way to say this, here's a list of coachable moments. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of their responsibility. She makes me so mad. Notice in much of what I say, how someone constructs their language will tell you how their mind software and brain hardware work in constructing a story. So this is something that we need to be sure that we have a working alliance so that we can be able to get away with saying whatever we need to say to a client. Another example, they may focus on responding rather than creating. Well, you know, I have to do this. They may see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Now, as you hear, some of these examples are really easy for me to say. When they experience a symptom in their bodies, they may medicate it away. That's like turning off the warning light, the dash of your car. Now, contrast that with an internal point of reference, someone who sees authority as their own. This is what we coach toward. Their premise is an acceptance of responsibility. Their theme, their experience is effectiveness. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are those characteristics in as some examples. They recognize accountability for their lives. They're proactive. They plan. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result and then look for alternatives. You know, we touched in the first seminar, a basic tenet of coaching is if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide simply not to continue, not to keep going and continue to inhabit a story they hope will come true. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion. Listen to how someone constructs themselves in terms of active versus passive positions. This will tell you where someone needs to be or what needs to be examined, in that it seems then like the story just kind of writes itself to just happen to you. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. Well, this just seems to keep happening. So, coachable moments, you eliminate all the outs, all the blind spots, all the justifications to look at writing a true and effective current story. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, once recognizing and owning a wellness story, third step, address the storylines and plots. There are two exercises that are almost always useful to me in beginning with a client. If I ask them to do basic things in the beginning, these are the two exercises I will ask them maybe after a first session of assessment. The ideals and the needs exercises, the workbook beginning page 1.12 and 1.14. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. Ideals are a personal model of value. It's an internal guide to purpose. Living up to a personal, attainable idea generates a sense of worth and esteem. Failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. That's the only place I know that shame comes from, of not living up to an internal ideal. A need is an essential requirement. It's a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. So I request that a client fill out the needs, do the needs and ideals exercise, and send me the top three needs and top three ideals. And I write them inside the front cover of the client's folder, because everything that we do subsequently in determining strategies and goals needs to be in alignment with those needs and ideals. When needs, ideals, strategies, and goals are in alignment, all of the client is going in the same direction. And that's dynamite then. Now, part of the assessment of a wellness story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. Now, a paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a kind of a theory or frame of reference. It's simply a way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but assume we see things just the way they are. So the brain has a mind of its own, and we are often of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, let's set up an exercise program and plan a savings plan, create a savings plan. The limbic system, the midbrain, says, let's have that cheesecake and order the big screen HDTV. Each struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. One of the unique abilities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is, I believe, the most important capacity that we can help a client develop, an empathy with himself or herself, the development of self-awareness. A couple of studies recently in the New England, in the Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind showed that the most salient quality for successful executives was self-reflection and self-awareness. Now, that was what the study focused on. I would substitute for every human being. It is one of the most effective things that we can do to help a client to make a difference for the time we spend them with them to make a difference for the rest of their lives, personally, professionally, business. So that means we can learn from our experiences and from the experiences of others as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things, reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they still work or if they're outdated. So in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all of your wellness storylines advance your plot? Another component here. Listen to your self-statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal reality. Whatever you attribute to others, another person or group or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like or dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. This means that as mentor coaches, we particularly need to take the client's point of reference from inside them to understand their construction of their story, not to superimpose ours or run in a play or assume that we know the answer. Now, listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary. It's a prerequisite to assessing changes. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious will likely be attributed to fate. And that includes the operating system that governs 90 to 95% of what we do. Said another way, you are always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. It's important to know specifically what they are and to see if you want to change any of them. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Now, we'll talk more about the art and science of how to structure a visualization. And there's a reprint of the visualization chapter from Outsmart Your Brain and Instruction Manual in the addendum to your workbook. Listen to the language in regard to goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says you created an out. There's not a full commitment. It's a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. So think about this. You know the words of someone not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, a trapdoor by not being totally committed and creating an out. When somebody says, well, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. This is what you want to move toward and have someone construct their plan, their commitment, before you meet with them again and say, well, I'm going to try to, what will you do? You're wanting a commitment. You're wanting them to make it out loud. You're probably, if you write down anything during the session, you probably will want to write down the thing or two they're going to commit to, because if they don't begin the next session there, when you check in with them, that's where you began, and pretty soon, out of self-defense, they'll begin reporting what they do because you're an accountability partner. Also, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it, feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out, when you rest well, at the time and later. Now, there are different types of responses that you get. First-order responses make it really hard. A huge dessert. It's going to taste good at the moment, but the residual aspect is going to be what it does to your body. Also reflect on what studies and your experience shows. The major taste, the major impact, is up to slightly over 80% is in the first three bites. After that, it's redundant. So your body's already accommodated to the sensation. So listen to your body, acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much, when you eat foods that are unhealthy or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Now, another way of thinking about this, symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel, a process that begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. It's a storyline needing to be heard. A symptom repeats until it's recognized or translated. Somatic language is literal, a pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. Milrad Pavic said it very simply. It's easier to fall ill than to learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. So, in a simple way of saying it, you're the author, not the victim of your symptom. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. That includes especially your body. Step four, decide what to change. So we're going to talk about change and a system of how to do it. We're inside the system of how to do it. Have for reference the first exercise in Module 2, four basic inquiries for story evaluation. That's point 2.4. Also have handy the exercise, 15 reflections to understand your story, your storyline. That's 2.10 in the workbook. Now, a precept for this step. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change, as I mentioned at the very beginning, is because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and brain work. Despite being presented, and this dovetails with the question that, or the observation that Joe made in the beginning, despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people don't make changes, even when they know it's in their best interest. Your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or your habits, it'll make it harder to change. So what that means practically is if someone said, well, I'm a procrastinator, immediately that's a coachable moment, because if they choose to stop themselves, if they have a plan, and that's the key element, there are only two things you need to proceed. One is to have a plan, and the second thing is to do it. So if they have a plan and decide not to do it, we've talked about that some last time, that is a choice. So we look at the choice architecture at that moment. So let's look at what's involved in deciding to change. So here's how the brain opposes change. And this is a whole conceptualization I want to close with, because I think this is really important. Our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or business story. So let's look at how the brain opposes change, then how we can use this information as mentor coaches to facilitate success. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider 10 precepts of how our brains work. Each of these, I think, will help you in guiding someone to write a new successful story. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. One, and this is in your outline as well, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason, and remember we talked about this in the middle of our first seminar, part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Things that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. So we don't have to think about, as I mentioned before, how to drive the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is energy efficient and frees the brain up to do other things. So the brain is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwire and growing new neurons for that purpose. Whatever has been repeated, even if it's a bad habit, gets wired. When these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain, where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted, so we feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with a lot more energy and attention. It's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet. So our minds have to lead the way. I've heard Ray Kurzweil say this in a seminar. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. One of his seminal books, possibly one of the more challenging books that I've read in recent time, The Singularity is Near When Humans Transcend Biology. Two, second principle, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to do what we expect and what we expect to see. We see what we expect as well, what our radar has been coded for. So when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, simply meaning the difference between what we expect and what we perceive. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right, and it creates discomfort, and it's designed to do that. The brain gets our attention. At times, it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember, for example, maybe the experience of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator to get a drink of milk while you're thinking about something else, and then, bam, you discover it was a sip of orange juice. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. The good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors. In other words, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So what this means, it also responds to mistakes. Now that's great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response to change itself. So let me do a simple exercise with you. I want to tell you some numbers, and you can write these down. But let me tell you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Usual answers, maybe 3 and 6, or even multiples of 3. Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third response will follow, a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. Extrapolation, looking at the future based on the past, has been called the most common mistake in investing when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, notice how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of a number of jokes, listing 2 things and a third non sequitur, set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So this is where knowing how the brain works is going to help us collaborate with a client, because they don't know how to collaborate with their brain. We're just learning this ourselves. We need to be sure we predict or envision the right things. 4, in terms of how the brain opposes change, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither one. They're both likely to not just not work, but to backfire, because studies show threats work short time, but they draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created behavior. Remember, what we get what we focus on, not what we want. recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the focus on neural patterns associated with lateness. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain to Joe. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition because the brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And I've talked about this before. I work with pro athletes, and they're not motivated to get up in the morning and go to the gym, but they do it because they know they have to do that in order to do what's next. You don't need motivation. You only need a plan and to stick to it. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Whenever there is an emotion involved, it shifts a state of mind to a whole different software program. So here's where an example may be helpful. The brain doesn't know the difference between anxiety and excitement. So if someone interprets an event in being anxious, then they're going to boot up a whole different software and treat it as danger, probably protect themselves, than if they interpret it as excitement and opportunity. So this is where we come in to help someone look at the opportunity here. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term enhance learning. Now, the time window is up to about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, with stimulation or stress, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. That means with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. So, under stress, we do 2 things. We may regress to an earlier mode, and we may hyper-focus on the most recent emotional events and lose the big picture, the recency bias. 8, in terms of how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. I see this, for example, in succession planning in a business where a founder 36 years ago has difficulty in passing on a business because of wanting things to be the same way, yet to another generation of people. So this is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to perturbate a story, to empathically challenge and strategically perturbate. Now, the last 2 principles I think are huge for coaching, especially huge. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis: enhanced environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. And think about it. That's what we do with our clients. We co-create. We stimulate thinking. We challenge. We story bust. We nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with 2 things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. With exercise, the number of hippocampal cells is 100% more. It doubles. Recently, these findings were replicated in humans in non-invasive studies, London taxicab drivers, and medical students at the University of Hamburg. Remember, the hippocampus, the site of creativity and memory. Another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. the number of cells goes down progressively with chronic stress. 10. Neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain, in other words, can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, traditional therapy and follow-up was to put the dysfunctional arm in a sling so that they didn't hurt themselves further. But then some research was done to put instead the good arm in the sling so that they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing. After 10 days of therapy, the patients regained significant use of an arm they thought would otherwise hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Another related example, not only do zoning laws change the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate the body part claims can be changed depending on its use. An expert braille reader has significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Similarly, classical guitarists have been studied for the brain area functioning for their dominant hand. Now, the good news, we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed, new highways to new communities in your brain. That's what we do as mentor coaches. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So here's a brief summary, because I want to have a bit of time at least for responses and questions. What neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to your wellness story. 1. Everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information, which means existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, because it can't happen any other way. The prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. In other words, a belief, a fact, a pattern is an anatomical reality in your brain. You can't just introduce a better way of doing something and expect it's going to overwrite what's already there, but change occurs from the inside. That's where the collaborative, stepwise, strategic work of the relationship occurs. 3, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. That's why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list the 4 reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. 4, partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's subjective reality, that's kind of redundant, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. So here's a final story as an example of this process of the neuroscience of change applied. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals. They visualized, wrote affirmation. After a few hours, one penguin had a breakthrough and flew a short distance. Everybody got excited. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, the penguins were each flying short distances around the room. Then the seminar was over, and they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. Okay, we're on discussion mode. If you'll, again, manage background noise, thoughts or questions or comments about anything, or clarifications about anything we've talked about. Is this making sense to you?
Very much so. This is Brenda. Sorry, Dad. Yes, it all makes great sense to me. I'm just thinking I would love to, I would need to listen to this tape a few times, I think, just to get the most benefit from it.
It does. It's a proven system, but it took a while to develop, and it takes a while to apply it, because change just doesn't occur with information or knowledge. Oh, okay. I wanted to, I will send you some information. I've had some inquiries. I am starting a new life story wellness licensed specialty certification coaches training tomorrow. And that's an online training, but it's also a live training. And any of you who are interested in that, let me know. I'll send around a note about that in response. I meant to do that today because they're two or three asked me about that, and I just didn't get back to it, but I will after the seminar. So thanks for that. Other questions, thoughts? We have just a minute or two. Any clarifications specifically? Well, again, whatever, as you do and reflect on this, jot down anything you'd like to talk about. We'll have a discussion at the beginning of next time. Thank you again for your kind words and feedback and energy into what we're doing. Appreciate it. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time with our final three roadmap steps.
Thank you.
Have a great rest.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye now.
Thanks, Dave. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, Dave.
Bye, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks.